Welcome to The Swing,
Canada's political podcast for a global audience.
I'm Yaroslav Baran.
I'm Heather Bakken. Today we're going to talk about the speech from the throne, how it compares to others, what goes into making it, and the significance of a different approach to mandate letters. How does it compare to others?
Well, this is a fairly typical throne speech. Some of them are very short, some of them are very long. To give you an example, you may remember the 1988 election was basically a referendum on a free trade agreement with the U.S. The throne speech after that was a short session, a single issue, to introduce and pass free trade legislation between Canada and the U.S. So that's an outlier. Most throne speeches are really kind of like what we saw today, a bit of a summary and rearticulation of what we heard from Mr. Carney and the Liberals during the platform, a little bit of everything.
It ran about 28 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was neither short, it was neither long. It was pretty typical as far as throne speeches go.
Okay. Before we get into the meat and potatoes of it, what goes into making the throne speech and how does it come together?
Well, throne speech is really part of a three-item set. The foundational document is really the election platform of the party that ends up winning an election. That's the policy foundation. There's a little bit about everything. There's something on housing, something on taxes, something on environment, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, something for everybody. And platforms tend to be long. So after the election, now remember, a platform is a partisan document. It was published by a political party. So after an election, the Prime Minister's office, and these are written by PMO, the Prime Minister's office then takes that partisan party platform and repackages it under the, you know, seal, under the coat of arms of Canada, and turns it into official government policy. So a throne speech is really the transition from platform to, which is a party document, to Government of Canada official policy. So it's really typically just a repackaging of a platform. And then the next stage normally is then taking that throne speech and parceling it out to the various ministers in the form of mandate letters. Each minister gets their chunk of the content in a personalized letter from the Prime Minister saying, okay, the government is focused on these things. These are yours. Your job is to do the following 10 things. Boom, 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 boom. And then another minister gets their part of the throne speech, along with additional details, additional articulation, and they get their chunk of it. This time around, we didn't get that third part with the, you know, with that parceling it out to different ministers to execute.
So you're saying a platform begets throne speech, begets mandate letters?
Yes, that would be the biblical way of explaining it, yes.
And we only have one mandate letter this time. So why did the Prime Minister choose to take this route, do you think?
Yeah, he did decide to do it differently this way. Instead of individualized mandate letters to all ministers, he issued just a single mandate letter for the entire cabinet, along with seven priorities.
Yeah.
Now, it's been said that this is his boardroom experience on display, that this is kind of the corporate Canada approach to governing. Really, it was a communication exercise. It took the concept of a mandate letter and turned it into a comms exercise with seven talking points. These are the seven things we're going to be doing. The idea behind it, according to those who drafted it, is to instill a sense of discipline and common purpose across the cabinet. This is our focus, these seven things and these seven things alone.
So it sounds like he's a macro manager, not a micromanager. And part of what he may be doing is enabling the ministers to bring, empowering them to bring their own ideas to the table and apply them as they see fit. In your experience, how has this played out in the past if there's a bit of an open-ended mandate for a specific ministry?
Well, I think your question, you know, hits the nail on the head. This common mandate letter was designed to instill greater focus, but in effect, it will probably have the opposite effect, because in the absence of individual mandate letters, then it kind of leaves things open-ended for that department. Let's say, for example, if you're the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans, and yes, you know, you receive that 7-point, you know, macro, all of cabinet mandate letter, and there's nothing in there on fisheries and oceans, then it kind of emboldens your department to start doing its own thing. See, mandate letters traditionally serve a very useful function in that they allow a minister to push back on organic departmental agendas and say to their deputy minister, you know, with the greatest of respect, these may be good ideas, but I've been charged with the prime minister to do the following things. I need to focus on those things. And it keeps all kinds of miscellaneous ideas at bay. But here we don't have that. So there probably will be more kind of freelancing by government departments in the absence of this, you know, of that traditional charge department by department.
Do you think there's an opportunity for the ministers to show their leadership, though? Can you think of, I'm thinking in 2008, 2009, Flaherty was really, really impressive. Although, ironically, I guess the current prime minister was part of the team that advised on that with the Bank of Canada. But, you know, there have been studies that show that there are three things that lead to success: autonomy, mastery, and praise. So AMP. Is there an opportunity for leaders to amp up in this scenario? Or do you think, again, like it's their multiplicity of interests with the bureaucrats versus maybe internal politics? Is that what I'm hearing from you, that could kind of make it a rudderless ship where it goes awry, goes off course?
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, yes. But, you know, we tend to hear this from every new prime minister. You know, new sheriff in town, we're going to do things differently. Under our government, ministers will be ministers. They will not just be executors. We heard that when Mr. Trudeau was sworn in. We heard that when Mr. Harper was sworn in. But then reality sinks in, 24/7 news cycles, social media age, information age, and then they recognize the need for central control and central discipline. So despite the best of intentions, every government starts with this new democratizing, decentralizing vision, but then they end up being just as disciplined as the government before them. And yeah, true, every government tends to produce one or two particularly strong ministers who end up gaining a little bit more autonomy from the prime minister's office because they demonstrate that they are highly capable, highly competent ministers.
Another thing about this I thought was really interesting, and I'd love your take on it, is the overarching narrative of unifying Canadians with their values, with their purpose, with a single focus on our mission to be a global player, kind of restoring us to glory. It reminds me of the League of Nations era, post-Second World War nation building. I felt a tinge of this from the King today.
Yeah, and that's frankly part of why the King was invited to deliver the throne speech. I mean, as our sovereign, it was a symbolic gesture of sovereignty of Canada, pushing back on this, you know, annexation talk from south of the border and demonstrating that, you know, as the King said, Canada is the true north, strong and free. So that was really part of the idea. And the speech kicked off with a value statement, you know, democracy, pluralism, rule of law, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a smart way to build a foundation of your government program and before getting into some of the details.
So a lot of pomp and circumstance for a 28-minute speech.
Oh, yeah, of course. That's always the case. You know, trumpeters and red carpets and, you know, pageantry, and that, you know, that comes with the territory. In fact, it was an organizational challenge for, you know, for all the protocol people planning for the throne speech, because ordinarily they'd have a much bigger Senate chamber, the normal permanent Senate chamber and center block, which is now under renovation. So they have a smaller space to work with. And ordinarily for a throne speech, they can issue out a whole bunch of invitations. For example, they would traditionally invite every single member of the Privy Council. There's, I don't know, 400 or 500 of them, former governors general, every former cabinet minister, et cetera, and most of them don't show up because, hey, it's just another throne speech. It's the GG reading a speech. But this time around, everybody wanted in. So there was huge demand to be in the room for that throne speech, and only about 10% of the available space to accommodate it all. So it was a real challenge putting it together, but I think they did it well. It was a good show.
If the policy manages to play out in a way that it's intended to, what are we looking at moving forward? Because we're in a critical time right now.
Well, I think an important point on the policy content of both the throne speech and the Liberal Party platform that begot that throne speech is that, you know, during the election campaign, we really saw a convergence of policy. Thematically, the Liberal and the Conservative platforms were really not that different. They were basically the same document, but the details tended to be different. So, you know, there's something to be said for the idea that under the present circumstances of, you know, facing a Donald Trump-led America and new challenges in the world, that we forged a new consensus in Canada about what it is that we do need to focus on. We cannot continue to take things like national defense for granted. We cannot take our sovereignty for granted. We really, really need to get our act together on interprovincial trade barriers and building a single unified economy and so on. So these are, I mean, many would argue that these are this is the traditional turf of conservatives, but this has become the new consensus agenda for the policy direction of this country.
Final thing, Canada brooch.
Oh, the Queen's brooch. That was gorgeous. I'd never seen that brooch before. That was really stunning.
All right, Yarrow. Well, we'll see what happens over the next week. And thanks a lot for sharing your insights.
Anytime, Heather.
Bye.